I'm going to further limit our First Amendment rights of our speakers here, but I am going to give them each 2 minutes to have rebuttal here. So I'm going to time it very strictly so we have time for a question and answer, but
wow.
Go ahead.
2 minutes. 2 minutes, it's kind of difficult to do so, but I think I do disagree with much of what Jeff says, but I'm always happy to be attacked from this side rather than that side, because I think it does put the things into arguments. Look, the basic question about how one deals with an antitrust law does run into the question of whether or not, when it's so misapplied, the entire thing just simply blows up. I give a much fuller treatment of that in the book on Principles for a Free Society than I do in the Skepticism and Freedom. And you have to understand that in certain cases, you can't get around the monopoly problem. When you have local exchange carriers, you have patents and so forth, it is a very difficult question to figure out how they're justified and when they ought to be used. The one simple observation I would make is that mergers are not always a substitute for cartels. Cartels, you can have separate firms. They don't have to have a complex ownership structure. They don't have to swap shares and all sorts of other things. If you stop the cartels and you allow the mergers, there would be at least some set of transactions that would not go in that particular direction. And even if you allowed the mergers and the firms became inefficient, other people coming from the outside would, in fact, quickly undermine the situation. So don't sort of give up on this. I think, in effect, you can do a better job than we've done. And here I would point out that the improvement in the antitrust philosophy under the Chicago influence between 1960 and 2000 is so vast that one should not completely despair. That's an area in which we've gotten better, not worse. With respect to taxation and slavery and theft, I agree that powerful metaphors always work. In fact, I often tell this story. It was one day when I was sitting in a Liberty Fund conference, similar crowd, and I was giving some of these consequentialist jargon arguments, and there was an English professor sitting beside me from Wofford College, and he just looked at me after listening to this for about 15 minutes, and he said, "Professor Epstein, I don't know you, but I can tell you the following thing. Having heard you for 15 minutes, I am perfectly confident that I could have you committed in any state of the union." That is because the jargon did not work well. And in fact, one of the things that I constantly stress, not in this lecture but in other lectures, is that you cannot get buy-in unless you can translate the sort of consequentialist jargon that you have into ordinary life. Now, let me just explain to you how that works. If you want to figure out why it is that people will respond to the movement to abolish slavery but won't respond to the movement to abolish taxation, you can't just look at what's taken side. You got to look at the benefit side of the transaction. And with slavery, ask the following simple question. If I were to enslave X, what's the return benefit to him? The answer turns out to be rather small. If we were to have a situation in which we impose a 2% tax on everybody in order to fund defense, courts, and public roads to which all have equal access, the return benefits are rather larger. And under these circumstances, there's an old maxim which says, if you have an average reciprocity of advantage, that's the kind of situation in which it's more likely that coercion will flourish. And it's the inability to make taxation flunk that test when slavery does that I think distinguishes between them. I'll stop right here.
I won't charge you for that time.
It's gotten cooler. It's gotten cooler. Okay, I'll only make one quick point because I want to hear what the audience has to say. But yeah, I agree that it's much easier to abolish slavery than to abolish taxation, which is why one has succeeded and one hasn't yet. But that's not the question. The question is, what kinds of arguments and what kinds of simple rules, what kinds of principles are most likely to give us the kind of society, the kind of free society that both Richard and I would like to live in? That's the essential issue.
Okay, we're ready to throw it open for question and answer. I'd just like to ask you to keep your questions brief so we can give the panelists a chance to answer them. No speeches, and please wait till Alice comes with the microphone after I recognize you before you ask your question so everybody can hear. This gentleman right here was first.
What is a behavioral economist, and what is a consequentialist?
Oh, those are real questions. You know, this is the jargon problem all over again, right? I mean, it turns out we know what we're talking about, and many people who aren't in the business don't. Let's just start with the consequentialist. The technical philosophical definition is the consequentialist is the opposite of the deontologist, which I'm sure solves all of your questions. And to say, I mean, that's what it means is the deontologist is somebody who says you figure out whether actions are right or wrong by looking at them in relationship to past things that have happened. So that it's wrong to hurt another individual, it's wrong to base your problems. Strongly intuitive, it's consequencing on what you did to him, what he did to you. The consequentialist says, look, these are the ways in which you enforce norms, but you're concerned about them with respect to the way in which they structure long-term social interactions, that is, with their consequences. And so instead of simply saying that there's a quote-unquote moral obligation to keep your promises, you say, if you don't keep your promises, how are you going to have exchange work? And if you can't get exchange work, how are you going to be able to get social cooperation? And if you can't get social cooperation, how are you going to be able to eat? And I think that's what happens is there is a very powerful connection between these two theories in the following way. And that is, if you look at all the traditional natural law bromides, which are sort of given as kind of abstract truths without any real foundational work, most of them square up amazingly well with sensible consequences. And here I would just simply state that I began my life as a Roman lawyer. I mean, not that I practiced in ancient Rome, but when I went to Oxford to study, the first thing they ever taught me was Roman law. And they basically were big believers in natural law. And if you look at the system they developed, their instincts were so unerring in the kinds of mid-level commercial transactions with which they were able to work that they rarely made a mistake. And 2,000 years later, to the extent that you're dealing with partnership rules and loan rules and bailments and, you know, sales, we, even in the United States, use rules that are about 99 and 44 100% Roman, except for the bad parts, which we've added by statute. Now, did you want to take on the behavioral economics stuff, or should I? You take a shot.
Let me give a quick answer on consequentialism.
Whoops.
If you're not a consequentialist, if you believe in deontological ethics, you believe certain things are right or wrong despite the consequences. Whereas if you're a consequentialist, then your moral views or your moral principles at some level are informed by the consequences.
And it's harder to be an absolutist as a consequentialist. So the tension is the strong, why is slavery wrong question is easier to answer as a deontologist. It's just wrong to enslave another human being, than it is as a consequentialist who's going to say, well, suppose it improves the GNP. Right? And you say, well, that's not the kind of consequence you want. And so what happens is you then have different kinds of consequentialists. And let me mention one of the profound splits. Those of us who come out of the old deontological tradition, as I do, that's where I started, tend to be what we call parishioners. That's another term. That is, we believe that consequences are only better if every individual under the new state of the world is better off than they were under the old state of the world, so that you don't have some prosper and some who get hurt. You're trying to do that. And there are other people who say, no, that requirement really isn't there. So that if you can make one person a slave and 10 people are left better off, go right ahead and do it. So you have that real split within the consequentialist community, and most libertarians are strong consequentialists, meaning rising tide has to raise all boats, are very deeply suspicious of selective rules. And then the question is, can you justify which form of consequentialism based on the consequences that they have for political life? I think you can. The moment we make it a free-for-all that 10 could enslave the 11th, there's always going to be the question, who's the odd man out? And the general answer is it's always the guy who's got the shortest straw.
Okay, who wants to do behavior?
I'll do behavior. Okay. Richard actually probably knows more about it, but I can give a shorter answer. behavioral economists are economists who have conducted various kinds of experiments and field work in order to look at human behavior. And some of them, not all of them, have concluded that sometimes people behave in ways that are counter to the underlying assumptions of economic rationality.
Let's have another question. We've got to get to another question.
You want to hear one?
Yeah, make it quick. Then.
Yeah, I will. I mean, the sub-schools are as follows. Dan Kahneman won the Nobel Prize because he proved that no matter what experiment you gave to people, they always got it wrong. So for him, the world is, we're not perfectly rational. We always use heuristics, a fancy word for a rule of thumbs, and they always lead to biases. The other school is actually run by a leading light is a German fellow named Gerd Gigerenz. And his title of his book is not Heuristics and Bias. It's Simple Rules That Make Us Smart. And you can guess who I'm more friendly with when it comes to sort of the intellectual orientation. And it's not field work that drives the cognitive die. It tends to be very stylized laboratory experiments with college students who don't understand the instructions to the question that they're given and who are never doing this in real-world context. To the extent that we do have field evidence, it turns out you put people under pressure, they actually do a little bit better when they're just thinking idly because there's so many sort of deep wiring kinds of arrangements which help to keep them in line.
Okay, this guy right back here.
And by the way, I have two full chapters in the book on this if you're curious.
And they're good chapters.
Yeah, that's something he won't disagree with, I mean. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed your talk. I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit, though, in your granted very brief two-minute rebuttal that you were given. I'm not sure if you really had an opportunity to respond to what I thought was maybe Jeff's harshest critique of your position, and that your justification for the classical liberal versus libertarian position is essentially a public goods problem, but that good government itself is a public good, and you are caught in a problem of the impossibility of a desirable minimal state. And I'm wondering, how is it that you answer this critique?
Okay, I mean, it's that's a very powerful critique, and the answers I would give are twofold. The first one is having to do with the self-interest model. It's very instructive. If you go back and you read the Hobbesian view of self-interest, it's relentlessly individual. More so, in fact, than the biology would support because it doesn't allow for sharing within kin and within family. The more accurate account of the way in which this thing works, I've always thought, was the Humean account of individual self-interest, which was individual self-interest which was tempered by confined generosity. Meaning, in effect, that there is a certain level of empathy that people have with other individuals which will force them to curb the way in which they respond to certain things and to act in somewhat non-selfish fashion, son of the time. And if you actually look at the empirical evidence, and there was just a recent study in the New York Times, I mean, they reported it, not that they didn't, in which it turns out that, you know, you shock one person with pain and you look at the mental lobes of another individual, they respond in a hurt fashion. And it's that ability to sort of work on these kinds of residuals, interdependent utilities, which essentially means that we are not caught in this impossible box because the economic assumptions of relentless self-interest don't work. That's the first point. The second point is a profoundly anti-Hayekian point about the way in which this works, which is the single most successful constitution that we've had, ours or either the national one or some of the state constitutions, far from being the result of spontaneous elaboration and evolution, were the result of constant deliberation by individuals who, for some weird reason, were put into a situation where it was no longer politic for them to act in selfish and provincial fashions. Now, how did this happen? Well, you put them in a crisis situation. And sometimes, if the whole ship goes down, the fact that you're on the top of the, you know, on the top deck of the Titanic and the last to drown isn't going to help you. You want to make sure that the whole thing doesn't shipwreck. And a little bit of that problem took place with the Articles of Confederation. And so given the fact that you faced mutual ruination, there was a strong incentive on the part of self-interested people, tempered by this generosity, and understanding something about their own weaknesses, to opt for structures which were coherent. And the thing that's most impressive, and here I disagree with Jeff, is if you look at the American constitutional experience, to the extent that these Supreme Court judges, the same judges, believe in the dominance of competitive equilibrium over state monopoly. Let's just leave it like that. Their rules on freedom of speech, interstate commerce, and so forth are so good that you could write economic answers based upon what these judges do. Then you get them into a situation where they don't believe this stuff, and they write gibberish. And so a large portion of it, you get these split brains, depends on exactly what we're doing here. The way, in effect, you form the Independent Institute and 1,000 other organizations, is there some people out there who realize that knowledge is a public good and you're trying to push the debate. And the truth about the matter is on many fronts, we are worse off than we were 40 years ago. But on many fronts, we are better off. And antitrust, paradoxically, is one where I think everybody would agree. It isn't perfect. But it's certainly a lot better than it was in the peak of the Warren Court. I mean, that caught me a Supreme Court clerkship, I have to tell you. Because somebody said, what do you think of the Warren Supreme Court antitrust opinions? I said, they're sick, essentially. And, you know, that ended it.
Okay.
Can I?
Yeah. Oh, you want to?
Yeah, I want to make a quick comment. I don't share Richard's constitutional fetishism.
Not a fetish.
I would, from the perspective of American history, I would argue that the problem with the Articles of Confederation was that it created a government that was too strong, not a government that was too weak. And to the extent that we had limited government under the U.S. Constitution, I don't think it was as a result of the Founding Fathers. It was a result of the political constellation of how the Constitution was interpreted and implemented. And if I were to, in other words, I don't assign this stellar role to the judiciary. And in fact, if I were to identify one sort of organization that was most responsible for limiting state power in American history, it would have been the Democratic Party as organized by Martin Van Buren. But I think there are myriad other influences as well. But that points to the fact that it's not... A constitution is not a magic bullet that will solve these problems. Because the constitution has to be interpreted, and it will become, and its interpretation will become the result of politics, and that means that you have this ongoing problem of fighting rent-seeking and preventing special interests from capturing the state.
Okay, this gentleman, that right here.
Yeah, the underlying premise, I think, of what you're saying is that freedom is diminishing on a monolithic basis, with certain exceptions such as antitrust law. Isn't, in fact, just going a little bit towards the other way with things like the Internet, which liberates individual people and is essentially uncontrollable by government. And taxes at one point were 70% top rate, and now they're much lower. And the Heritage Foundation, I believe, does a study internationally finds indexes of freedom actually increasing somewhat. So haven't we reached a point where things will tend to, over time, become more free?
Look, I agree with some of that. I'm not a complete pessimist, but remember the time span under which we were talking. Most of the reforms that I talked about on the federalism issue, on the labor regulation issues and so forth that deal with the modern American system were reforms that were introduced in the period, the progressive era between 1915, say, and 1937 is a rough point, where every single important American intellectual, public intellectual figure thought that a larger government was a better result, and the courts responded in time. If you take the last 50 years, on balance, I think it's been very complicated. There's no question that you're right about cyberspace and you're right about the Internet. I think that the attitude towards many New Deal regulations, like, you know, can banks sell stocks and stuff like that, we've repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. Not that anybody really cares anymore, but you did. And you know what? The world didn't fall to pieces, and these commercial markets became much better. We've done infinitely better on the tariff fronts than we used to do 100 years ago. In real terms, they're down. Now, when you support the sugar tariff, you actually have to be embarrassed about it, as opposed to treating it as simply business as usual. But there are some areas in which it goes in the opposite direction. There is no question in the United States that the regulation of the employment relationship, which is one of the things which is most easily marketized without any regulation whatsoever, has increased first in the New Deal. But unlike antitrust law, it didn't moderate when you got to the Johnson or the modern age. So that if you start in 1960s, you get the anti-discrimination laws. Mild and moderate, we were told by Hubert Humphrey, but a 900-pound gorilla. So then, in fact, we do off, you know, why, by the way, there are no Republicans in this room, I hope. but the thing to remember is when it came to age and disability, and rather family leave and things like that, you had a bipartisan coalition. When they eliminated mandatory retirement, against which I railed, I mean, you know, voluntary mandatory retirement in the university, it was 94-0 in the United States Senate. I mean, you've got to understand where it was. And so that's an area in which it's clear that we've gone south. On the other hand, union power in the United States in the private sector, way the hell down. But union power in the public sector, way the hell up, to the point where there are now more members of, or will be within a year, more members of public unions, public service unions, than of private unions in the United States. where these states are so feckless, they essentially order their local municipalities to cave into a union. They can't even fight them, which is why the growth has happened. So it's just highly variegated, and it's a complicated situation. And all I was doing was picking on some strands where I think things have gone worse. But if you're asking me where it is on balance, we're in slightly better shape today, I agree with you, than we were, in my judgment, when I became an academic in 1968.
Okay.
And Jeff, do you agree or not?
I agree.
Okay. Right here on the front.
One thing I think that does limit the power of government is the concept of individual rights. And you can have a constitution, but if you don't have a moral limit on government, individual rights, then you really don't have anything to sustain the government in its pursuit of respect for people's rights. And I wonder, I think that Jeff would agree with the concept of individual rights. I don't think that you really do agree with such a concept, because you believe that it is proper for the state to take people's money from them without their consent. How is this different from simply robbing somebody?
Well, I mean, the robber doesn't give you anything in exchange.
Well, suppose he did. Would that make it right?
Well, yes. The answer is, the answer is yes and no. Let me give it. The answer is surely no if what you did is the robber took something from you and just gave you something as one person, as an individual. But if there is a serious coordination problem and you take from everybody and you give back to everybody something which they could not achieve through voluntary arrangements, that's the logic of forced exchange, then you have an economic improvement in which, if you ask people up or down, not whether they could opt out of this system, be the free rider, but whether they would have everybody taxed and everybody benefited, or nobody taxed and nobody benefited, they would all vote for the tax. That's what James Buchanan called the unanimity principle, and in effect, in this hypothetical world, that's the way in which it works. That's the essential argument. And essentially, the way in which I put it, if you go through my takings book, which is a constitutional interpretation, because our Constitution is not a libertarian constitution. It says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation, which meaning that it can be taken if just compensation is provided. Essentially, what I came to the conclusion was, magically, if you actually ran this thing through systematically, it meant, in effect, that you could do only positive-sum projects, subjectively measured. So it is individualism in the strong sense that you are the master of your own utility function. You decide what you value and what you do not. And that, in effect, that nobody could be prejudiced, subjectively speaking, by a government program when all of its systematic pluses and minuses were taken into account. And that's very different from robbery. And it seems to me, in fact, the political point that I would make is, in this room, you know, the taxation is theft argument may have a chance, probably would win. But if you try to go out into an audience which is essentially small government types out there, you're going to lose. And, you know, you're going to win on slavery and lose on taxation. And the reason is the distribution of return benefits is so radically different under the two systems that you must take that into account. Let me give you another illustration. Gary Leibercap and other people have worked about common pools, you know, getting oil and gas out of the ground. And it turns out the optimal size of a farm is much smaller than the optimal size of a pool. If you try to do this by voluntary organization as opposed to mandatory state pooling, the amount of oil and gas that you get out in profits probably goes down by a factor of 4 or 5. And you ask, what's the number of people which creates this impossible blockade system? Empirically, the number's around 6. I mean, very small numbers create immense amounts of chaos. And what you see is the oil and gas men, these hardy individuals, go to the Texas State Power Company and say, please help us organize these fields before we kill each other. So there is a difference.
Okay, Jeff, you want to make
a comment? Yeah, just a quick comment. I concede that the taxation is theft argument is, at least the first time you present it by itself, is going to fail with a general audience. But so is the New Deal is unconstitutional argument, also going to fail with a general audience. I don't see how far that gets us.
Well, the answer is you don't present the New Deal argument like that. You sort of slowly build up to it. And you show that it doesn't require you eliminate taxation.
Okay, this gentleman right here in the front.
It seems to me that the main argument that the common voter has for transfer taxation is that capitalism itself is based largely on some element of luck. Okay, it's not all ability, and it's not all. And therefore, it seemed to them that it's sort of in the Christian morality idea that we share by force. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that argument that we're really only readjusting this unjust system? Because, you know, Bill Gates is brilliant, but not, you know, a million times more than the common man.
Okay. I actually wrote a paper called Luck. Come bad chance and we join to it our strength and teach it art and length itself or us to advance. That was John Donne. That was those lines that I quoted. But anyhow, let me give you the first thing. That is, the basic principle of rectification for wrongs is always what you have done to me. To the extent that those are relatively infrequent, you could run a system of rectification which has individual responsibility for individual action. One of the problems that you get when you use luck as a test for entitlement is you can't figure out who it is who's supposed to do the pain. I mean, in terms of a coercion system. Because what happens is you've had bad luck, you got hit by a truck, but later you're the one he's trying to sue and you just lost a relative the other day. And it turns out, if you've ever worked in the academic business with students in trouble, everybody's had bad luck. I mean, the second point about it, because this is actually the more serious half of it, is this is not an idle consideration. The traditional libertarian view on charity was that it was an imperfect obligation. It was not essentially a matter of free choice. And what they meant by imperfect was that, as a matter of conscience and social practices, other people would call you wrong if you had plenty and you left nothing for anybody else. But two things were true about it. One is you could aid anybody whom you damn well pleased. You didn't have to help everybody. So that the matching problem, which I mentioned for luck as a social thing, essentially disappears. And then, in effect, once you do all of this stuff, if everybody else fills in the rest of the gap, it will work. And it is quite striking that if you actually look at the level of charitable contribution for the poor before the rise of mandatory systems, you will discover that there was nobody who died on the street, notwithstanding bad luck, because of all these second-tier institutions which managed to hold it. And this is true when the sort of the total income on a per capita basis, or the per capita basis income in the United States, was about a tenth of what it is today. So that I think in the end that one of the great tragedies of the welfare state is it killed private benevolence, substituted very powerful coercive systems, which are then spent in such a promiscuous way that the tough love which makes charity work is no longer possible. Because why go into a religious program that's going to make you do something to get something if somebody's going to give you that and tell you you're just a goddamn victim and you have nothing to do but to worry for yourself? So, I mean, there is a kind of an answer to this problem within the system. But I think, in effect, it's extremely difficult to talk about as an entitlement. And this is my answer to Bill Gates. I said, Bill, you and you are rich. I mean, it's a true story. Not that I told him, but I would if he came by. I said, you know, look, you miserable human being, you. You earn $80 billion. You can't figure out a way to spend it on Matisse's. And your original idea was to basically hold it until you died and then give it to a charitable foundation. And even you weren't so thick to realize that just keeping it there when you could do something in your own life and shape it. So all of a sudden you created a foundation of $20 billion here and gave out money there. In effect, your wealth has done more to help the poor people in the United States than that wealth that had been evenly distributed, by virtue of the fact that you're entitled and able to implement a program privately conceived that responds to all the difficulties which we have said. And it's not the estate tax that's driving you on this particular thing. It didn't drive John D. Rockefeller. It's your own sense of shared humanity. It's that little element of empathy which becomes a little bit larger for guys who've got $80 billion in the bank.
Okay, the last question here, right?
Well, you don't have to stop. We'll just keep going.
I'm not sure if you answered this in your book, but it seems as if many conservatives can justify social regulation, social control, using basically a public good argument, as well as its cost-benefit analysis. And one example of that might be the illegalization of drugs. How do you answer that?
Drugs is an extremely difficult question to deal with, and let me tell you the way in which I answer this question and the approach that I would give to it. And then Jeff can come back in a sort of small state world and figure out whether or not he would do more or less the same thing. I mean, my first, I do it with a series of shifting presumptions. And the first presumption, if anybody wants to blow his own particular brains out by taking these drugs, do it. That's fine. But on the other hand, if you then ask the next question, when some people take these drugs, they not only blow their own brains out, but they act in asocial behaviors with respect to others. Then, in effect, what you have to do is to have a system in which you punish the wrongful conduct which they engage in, all right? And you don't allow them an excuse based on non-responsibility in virtue of the drugs that they've consumed. And if you did that, that would be a start. The hard problem about this for regulation is a hard thing for every one of us. Suppose you have somebody who takes a drug and you don't know whether he will or will not engage in various forms of violence. And you do know that if he does engage in the forms of violence, he will not be able to provide compensation in question. What you then have to do is to make a very difficult kind of risk analysis as to whether or not the dangers of non-compensation of people who in fact use these sorts of drugs and cause harm to others is so great that you will limit the consumption in question. We make these choices all the time. When you tell people they can't drink alcohol after 3 o'clock in the morning, what you're saying in effect is we think that the likelihood of drunk driving at that particular time with that level of imbibement is a real danger. And so what we do is we criminalize things which have high positive consequences. And so to me, the drug debate is whether or not the driving while drugged is like driving while drunk. And if it is, I'm going to regulate it without embarrassment. And if it's not, I'm going to let them do it. But I'm going to tell them, you know, you're grown men and women. I'm not going to give you an excuse from the criminal law. And I'm not going to subsidize your use by bailing you out after you've gone. We're running a cold turkey operation. Because right now what we do is we throw people in jail, which cost everybody money. And then we subsidize their rehabilitation programs, which cost everybody money. I think, in effect, what you want to do is to stop the potential uncertain harm and leave the improvement to private agencies that are bold enough or foolish enough to try to undertake that form of rehabilitation. Now, do you agree with that or not?
No. A simpler solution is privately owned roads in which the road owners establish the rules.
Well, since somebody breaks on the road and drunk and runs down one of your drivers, I mean now...
But we're both talking about ideal solutions, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about one. I think you could reduce subsidies and increase penalties which are tied to wrongful conduct. And I think, in fact, one of the improvements in the criminal system is that there is a noticeable reluctance on people of all sides of the political spectrum to allow the personal excuses based upon fatigue, insanity, drug use, or anything else to interfere. And we've done a better job on the criminal side in the last 40 years than we did before. There used to be something known as dura mat, which meant that all you had to do was to prove that your conduct was the product of a mental defect undefined. And that was fairly widespread. And the rules today make it exceedingly rare that one actually hears anything about the insanity defense. I mean, so I think that's a general improvement. And it ties in with your theme, Bill, which is this is a case where individual responsibility really does apply. And we do see, in effect, fairly high standards in the criminal law relative to what we used to see when Durham was decided 50 years ago.
Okay, that's all the time we have tonight, and I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Thank our speakers for being an excellent, making excellent presentations, and I think we had a good debate. So, give them a big hand.
Thank you.
And don't forget one last thing. Don't forget to pick up a copy of the book on your way out, and don't forget Jeff's book as well. Thanks for coming.